If there's one song that conjures up warm June days in an idealised rural setting, it's got to be The Rosebud in June. It really brings out the Luddites in me. I want to go back to the soil. I want to tend to the sheep in the rolling uplands. I want to bring the harvest in by hand and then dance under the harvest moon to a slightly wonky fiddle. I know that my ancestors scraped a difficult living as tenant farmers, that they worked night and day, died in childbirth, or ended their days in the workhouse. But whenever I hear this song, I don't care about any of that. I want that romantic life, the one that's only ever really existed in small moments within a lifetime of toil. I'm far from alone here. It's a song that was popular with English folk song collectors in the late 19th and early 20th century, especially those who went out looking for this idealised rural life. And there may be a good reason for this, because there is plenty of evidence that this is a song which was written precisely to evoke such emotions. Welcome to Handed Down, where we celebrate traditional songs and the people who sing them. I'm Jenny Shaw, and today I'm delving not just into our past, but into our desires and dreams to explore this most evocative song. Rosebud in June, also known as the Sheep Shearing Song, can be found in the work of an affable and mild-mannered playwright working in early 18th century London. It was a time of change and conflict. Queen Anne's death brought a peaceful handover to the new King George, but the union between England and Scotland was under strain, and the Jacobites, the descendants of the deposed Catholic branch of the Stuart dynasty, created civil unrest and the beginning of a rebellion that was to rumble on for several decades. Against this backdrop, Charles Johnson wrote his plays. Originally trained as a lawyer, he was a friend of the actor and manager of Drury Lane Theatre, Robert Wilkes. Johnson was known as a cheerful, amiable man, and a little more fond of his food than was good for him. And his plays offered the audience an amiable feast. Classical themes jostle with comedy, tragedy, sentimental passages, and musical numbers. The Country Lasses, also known as The Custom of the Manor, is very much a sentimental play. Two young men travel to the countryside and meet two young women, the country lasses of the title. While being entertained by their father, a former city gentleman, they attempt to seduce the women, with results that were clearly hilarious to the contemporary audience. The play reflects the over-sophisticated London audience's disdain for the country and all things rustic, and yet the country setting provides an opportunity to hold up the mirror and satirise this urban audience. In the end, it's a tale of affection over immorality. One of the young men genuinely falls in love and marries his lass. The other couple is more complex. Both of them are less inclined to conform, and the man has some deeply questionable views on seduction by today's standards. But the other characters persuade them to settle for an uneasy truce, and they promise to marry each other after 2 years, if they still feel like it. The Sheep Shearing Song, which appears towards the beginning of the play, may have been taken from tradition, but most likely it was written by Charles Johnson himself and set to music by John Barrett, who wrote the incidental music for the play. The tunes credited to Barrett in a contemporary collection, The Merry Musician, or A Cure for the Spleen, which describes itself as being a collection of the most diverting songs and pleasant ballads set to music, adapted to every taste and humour, together with a curious compound of state pills to allay the malady of malcontents. Here, mirth and music both appear, and songs diverting, new and rare, biting satire, smooth though keen, the surest physic for the spleen, by which both age and youth may be from indolence and vapours free.
When the rose is in bud and the violets blow, when the birds sing us love songs on every bough, when the cowslips and daisies and daffodils spread and adorn and perfume the sweet flowery mead, when without the plough fat oxen low, and the lads and the lasses the sheep shearing go. The cleanly milk pail is filled with brown ale, our table's the grass, where we sit and we'll sing and we'll dance in a ring, and every lad has his lass, when without the plough, fat oxen low, the lads and the lasses, the sheep shearing go.
The novelist and poet Thomas Hardy had strong views on folk music, and he was an accomplished fiddle player from his early years and throughout his life. In addition to his writing, Hardy devoted time to preserving the songs of his youth. He was concerned about the waning popularity of traditional country songs in the face of what he described as comic songs from the music halls. And in that sense, he had a lot in common with later folk song collectors, which I'll come on to later. And like many other collectors, Hardy recognised the cultural significance of country songs and believed in their importance in capturing the essence of rural life and the experiences of working class people. In Hardy's novels, songs sung by his characters often help to convey their social class and their cultural context. And that's especially true for his female characters, who would sing either refined parlour songs or country songs to emphasise their class. But in the early novel, Under the Greenwood Tree, it's the young Dick Dewey that opens the story with a rustic song. To dwellers in a wood, almost every species of tree has its voice as well as its features. At the passing of the breeze, the fir trees sob and moan no less distinctly than they rock. The holly whistles as it battles with itself. The ash hisses amid its quiverings. The beech rustles while its flat boughs rise and fall. And winter, which modifies the note of such trees as shed their leaves, does not destroy its individuality. On a cold and starry Christmas Eve, within living memory, a man was passing up a lane towards Mellstock Cross in the darkness of a plantation that whispered thus distinctively to his intelligence. All the evidences of his nature were those afforded by the spirit of his footsteps, which succeeded each other lightly and quickly, and by the liveliness of his voice as he sang in a rural cadence.
With the rose and the lily and the daffodowndilly, the lads and the lasses, the sheep shearing go.
Here's a similar version, which was collected by the Hammond brothers in Dorset in 1906.
Here's the rosebud in June, the sweet violets in bloom, and the birds singing gaily on every green bough, the pink and the lily and the daffodowndilly, to adorn and perfume the sweet meadows in June. Whilst out of the plough the fat oxen go slow, and the lads and the lasses, the sheep shearing go.
Like many of my generation and my parents' generation, I first heard The Rosebud in June sung by Steel Eye Span with their beautiful harmonies, though in retrospect it's quite slow and sombre for a song that self-describes as a celebratory dance. But this is likely the most widely known version of this song, not only due to the success of Steel Eye Span, but also because of its use by Gustav Holst in his Somerset Rhapsody. Now, this version was collected in a pub in 1904 by Cecil Sharp from a William King, who was a tenant farmer from West Hastree in Somerset, and it was published in the Folk Song Journal in the following year. But the story is a little more complex than it might appear. Sharp collected the song a week before William King won a prize for it at a folk song competition organised by the collector Frank Kidson. These competitions were judged on the merits of the song rather than the quality of the performance, which I think is a really clever idea to flush out some great songs. These two giants of the Edwardian folk song revival, Cecil Sharp and Frank Kidson, both did very important work in preserving the remnants of folk song in the early 20th century. But they were contrasting characters who took a wildly different approach. Kidson was a scholarly and unassuming character who was collaborative and open with his collection. About the songs and tunes themselves, he seems to have taken quite a pragmatic view. They were good songs. He wanted to preserve them. But for him, they sat within a historic context, and he was a great authority on written sources of old songs. Cecil Sharp, while he had many admirable qualities, could not have been described as unassuming. He was a big thinker on a mission with romantic views about the origins and significance and potential of folk song and dance. And I don't think it would be an exaggeration to say that he saw its collection and promulgation as a fight for the nation's soul. He was very successful in embedding folk song in the school curriculum, which is how many of us in the UK learned some of these songs, although, of course, they were the cleaned up versions. Every movement needs both sorts of characters, historians and ethnographers, and neither can be immune from their own cultural bias and interpretation. Both of these collectors have left us a great legacy for musicians and historians, but I will say that I know which one of them I'd rather have worked with. But personal views aside, Cecil Sharp was a man on a mission, and it was under his name that the song was published. Like many late 19th century and early 20th century collectors, Sharp was concerned about the malign impact of music hall on the singing of traditional English songs. These popular songs were starting to take over from the traditional country songs just because many people liked them better. However, folk song collectors tended to take quite a dim view of them as being vulgar. There is some irony in this view when we consider that this quintessential English folk song, The Rosebud in June, has its origins in popular theatre. But there's no doubt that the song has persisted to this day because of its popularity with ordinary folk, who found it satisfying to sing and entertaining to listen to long after the play itself had passed into obscurity. So while it wasn't originally created through some mystical bucolic process, the versions we know today have been filtered and carried through English rural life, a process that's now been killed off by recorded music. But what makes one form of music better than another, or more worthy of preservation? Stripped of mysticism and nationalism, folk songs are just songs, with diverse and sometimes obscure origins. And those that are performed today are the ones that in some way speak to us, either through their tune or their words or both. Thanks to the many collectors and commentators, and especially to the internet, we have a wealth of songs and tunes available to us, and what we choose to do with them is entirely up to us, although it is inevitably going to be shaped by popular taste and, I'm afraid to say, market forces. I'm going to turn now to Ralph Vaughan Williams, who wrote in a letter to his good friend Cecil Sharp, "If the folk song has nothing to say to us as we are now, without a sham return to an imaginary and probably quite illusory Arcadia of several centuries ago, then I would burn all the collections I could lay hands on and their singers with them." Okay. And yet this is the man whose most popular work is The Lark Ascending, which was inspired by a poem from a previous generation and which these days is associated with a lost way of life and even a loss of innocence. It's a rural idyll written on the eve of conflict and providing balm to the nation after the unimaginable losses of the First World War. Because of this, I think that maybe Vaughan Williams might have understood that folk song can speak to us now precisely because it does provide the escapism of a romanticised rural past, even while we know all along that really it's no more than a fantasy, like Middle Earth or Narnia, that helps us to cope with the here and now. Stay tuned after the song to hear an old man's strange twist on this song.
It's a rosebud in June, and the violet's in full bloom, and the small bird's singing on every green spray. We'll pipe and we'll sing love, we'll dance in a ring love, when each lad takes his lass all on the green grass, and it's all to plough where the fat oxen graze low. And the lad and the lasses to sheep shearing go. When we have all sheared all our jolly, jolly sheep, what joy can be greater than to talk of their increase? We'll pipe and we'll sing love, we'll dance in a ring love, when each lad takes his lass all on the green grass, and it's all to plough where the fat oxen graze low, and the lads and the lasses to sheep shearing go. For their pleasure it is good, it's the best of all our food, and their wool it will clothe us and keep our backs from the cold. We'll pipe and we'll sing love, we'll dance in a ring love, when each lad takes his lass all on the green grass, and it's all to plough where the fat oxen graze low. And the lads and the lasses to sheep shearing go. It's the ewes and the lambs, it's the hogs and the rams, and the fat wethers too, they will make a fine show. We'll pipe and we'll sing love, we'll dance in a ring love, when each lad takes his lass all on the green grass, and it's all to plough where the fat oxen graze low. And the lads and the lasses to sheep shearing go.
So the Hammond brothers were in Dorset on one of their epic song collecting tours. And while they were there, they spent time with Mr. William Bartlett. He was a long-term resident of the Wimborne Union Workhouse, and he gave them 40 songs in total. But as the brothers noted, he was sometimes confused between them. He came out with two unusual variants or fragments of what was clearly the sheep shearing song. And here's one of them.
The horses go fast and the oxen go slow. Oh, where are all the the lads and lasses that to sheep shearing go, to sheep shearing go, to sheep shearing go. Oh, where are all the lads and lasses that to sheep shearing go?
So I think it's just a great example of how the oral tradition can shape and change songs over time. So I really want to thank you for listening to the show. And there's something that I'd like to ask you. Now, I am in the very fortunate position that I don't need to ask for subscriptions or donations to run this podcast. So I'd like to ask you to pay it forward by supporting up-and-coming folk musicians and especially young artists. So anything that you can do, going to their gigs, crowdfunding their albums, that's just a great way of keeping our folk tradition alive. I'm going to be back as soon as I can with a new episode. But in the meantime, you take care.